The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
This is the Taisho. The Taisho, the talk for the first day of our Sesshin. Taisho is roughly translated as the demonstration of the shout that reverberates throughout the whole universe, throughout our hearts and minds. And today, I have the honor of sharing the Taisho with Melissa Roshi. I will give the first portion, and Melissa will give the second. It is the tradition at Boundless Way to look into a koan for every sesshin. And this sesshin is no different. Koans are teaching stories that have been handed down to us from many, many hundreds of years from our great ancestors. The word koan means public case, a case to study, a case that's public. And what's more public than reality? Right here, right out in front of you, nothing hidden. And so when we receive this talk, we receive it with our full open heart and mind. Let the words wash over you. What stays, stays. What doesn't, doesn't. The Dharma is what's here, not hidden. I don't have the Dharma for you. The Dharma is here and what arises in this moment, in this place. So our koan that we will be looking into is a koan that comes from the Blue Cliff Record collection of koans and features a teacher who is one of our great ancestors, Dongshan, the founder of the Saodong School, known today as in our school as the Soto School, the one of two Soto and the Rinzai are the two remaining schools of Zen passed down to us from many, many centuries. Dongshan lived in China in around the 7th century. And this story is about a meeting between a student and a teacher in a private meeting. Private meeting like the ones we will be doing in the afternoon, Doksan. And so here's the story. A monk asked Dongshan, when cold and heat visit us, how should we avoid them? Dongshan said, why not go where there is neither cold nor heat? The monk asked, where is there neither cold nor heat? Dongshan said, when it is cold, kill yourself with cold. When it is hot, kill yourself with heat. So we are here in Sesshin, the first Sesshin of the year in the winter. In the Northeast, it is quite cold. Somewhere around the world, we have other folks, maybe it's not as cold, but winter itself is a teacher. It brings about many different shifts, shifts in weather, shifts in light, shifts in air, shifts in health. I myself have suffered two colds or two sicknesses this winter already. Very unusual for me. Winter shows itself as a challenge. This koan is a direct mirror of our life here and now in Sesshin. The monk asks, how do I avoid cold and heat? In other words, when discomfort arises, how do I avoid it? How do I get away from it? This reflex is probably quite common for all of us. When the world presses on us, we look for an exit, don't we? Discomfort arises. A knee-jerk reaction. How do I avoid this? How do I get away from this? This is entwined in our DNA. All of our great ancestors, to cave dwellers and desert dwellers, wherever, avoided discomfort as part of their lives. And fortunately, they did because we are here now. And yet our lives, even in the lives of Dongshan, discomfort, avoiding discomfort, limits our life. The monk knew this, and certainly Dongshan knew this. Dongshan points to a place beyond avoidance. He first says, well, why don't you go to a place where there's no cold or heat? Quite enticing. Perhaps you might have searched in your life at some point for a place where you could avoid or barrier up against the discomfort of your life. I know I did, and I have, and I continue to. My whole journey to Zen, which started in middle age, was a response to my life and the circumstances at the time. At middle age, I had already been battered around quite a bit, bloodied and knocked down onto the mat. And I imagined Zen to be some sort of salve, or perhaps an armor to the life that had been so brutal in many ways. I had these imaginary pictures and things I'd seen on the internet of these shiny-headed monks in all in beautiful black robes sitting still like mountains in the monastery. And I thought, wow, if that could be me, I wouldn't be bowled over by life so much. These guys looked like they didn't have any problems. Of course, only a little while in Zazen in practice taught me otherwise. In fact, quite the opposite. This practice makes me porous, makes me more open to the discomfort of life. So Dongshan, the monk, says, you know, where is this place? Where is this place that there's no cold or heat? Tell me. The monastery? Some special state that I need to receive or come to in my practice? And Dongshan's answer lands like a hammer. When it's cold, kill yourself with cold. When it's hot, kill yourself with heat. Now, this isn't about harming the body, if that's what you think. You've missed it completely. This is about the death of separation. The separation from the one who always is several steps away from their experience. The one who looks at life and explains it, makes a story about it. That one is all of us. Always two or three steps away, conceptualizing reality, creating maps of reality. Very helpful maps, by the way, but maps nonetheless. The self that dies is the one that stands outside experience, the one that's constantly negotiating for a better something. Cold discomfort is practice. True cold is a sensation before the story about it. Resistance to life, whether temperature or situation, adds the suffering on top of the sensation. And becoming fully cold, fully hot, dissolves that extra layer. In our sutra service, we read Liberation from All Obstructions by the contemporary teacher, Hogan Bays. He goes on with this long litany of situations of life. If there's cost, I choose to pay. If there's sorrow, I choose to grieve. When burning, I choose heat. He uses this word choose, which can be a little bit of a difficult thing to grasp hold of, because he's listing these items, these situations of our lives, which are all too common, and asking us to choose. But what he's really asking us to choose is our life. We simply need, and our place in this world is to choose our life, whatever form it takes. There is a constellation of experiences of a human being. And our job here as Buddhists, as Zen practitioners, as people who are participating in this sesshin, is to feel and enter our life as fully and open as we can. That is our job as human beings, because our life is precious and it will be over much too quickly. We do it for ourselves and we do it for others. To not do so is to not live your life, is to shrink away from your life, to cower in the presence of all that is your life. This place, which neither hot nor cold or heat, is not a special state or a location. It's the intimacy of no distance between your body, you, and the experience. The temperature remains the same. There's still the shivering, there's still the sweating. What falls away is the separation. Now, this really shows up in sesshin. Sesshin is a magnifying glass for this. All of these difficulties, discomforts rise. Discomforts of the body, discomforts of the mind and the heart. The winter sesshin brings its particular challenges just from the weather, and maybe the difficulties of being mobile. The summer sesshin also, you'd be surprised. People shiver quite a bit in the summer sesshin when we have our AC units on. And the discomfort is there, no matter what. It can't be escaped, although we try. We do our best to create our stories. This shouldn't be happening. How dare they? Cold feet, tight shoulders, restless mind. Discomfort is the gate rather than the interruption. Zazen, our practice that is the fundamental practice here, is a complete inclusion of the moment. Complete inclusion, which requires your participation and your intention. And so when you meet discomfort, bringing attention to it directly into the sensation, staying with the texture, the movement, the change. It's never the same. And allowing the commentary to fade through the intimacy with this whatever situation. Now, this koan brings up temperature, but temperature can be seen in many different guises. Cold as grief, loneliness, dullness. Grief is a kind of winter. There is a darkness to it, a contraction. And yet grief is the other side of love. Surprisingly. I heard it said, I believe it was, I can't pin the author down. Oh, Stephen Jenkinson, that's who it was. Said something remarkable. I heard in an interview, he said that grief is loving that which has fallen from view. And love is grieving that which has yet to do so. Do you see how avoiding one negates the other? Can you see how it's impossible to avoid or just have one part of love or one part of life without the other? Life is the full field. You can't pick and choose. You can't decide, oh, this is the part of life that I want, and I'm going to collect all of it for myself, and the other I'm just going to shove away. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. And heat as anger, urgency, desire, all of these emotional climates, the same teaching applies. Winter does not negotiate. Cold does not negotiate. Practice asks us to meet life as it arises. And so I invite you to ask yourself, who is the one that's trying to avoid this? What happens when that one relaxes? Let this sesshin be fully the sesshin, this winter be fully winter, and this life and practice be fully this life and practice. And when the cold comes, be the cold all the way through. And now I want to pass it along to Melissa Roshi.
Thanks. Thank you, Michael. So what a wonderful explication of this koan already. One of the fun things about sharing a talk is listening to closely to see if there's anything missing from the first speaker. And I couldn't find very much missing. But where I do want to go with this, sinking even more deeply into the koan, is what came up for me, which was a great appreciation for this teaching from our ancestor Dongshan. He was someone who was quite a pioneer in emphasizing this very teaching that Michael was emphasizing. To be where you happen to be, but to see that being from many different angles. He was famous for inventing a schema for this called the five ranks, or we call them the five modes. Five different ways of perceiving our own minds, bodies, hearts. This shifting is mirrored in the koan. The point of view shifts back and forth from the teacher to the student. But also the teacher shifts his own way of explaining, and hopefully the student shifts his own way of receiving the teaching. One of the instructions that we may have said, but probably forgot, is that when we're listening to a Dharma talk, we sit still in Zazen. We don't move around. Because this receiving of these words is contingent on being fully present to what's happening in the mind and the body without interfering. And the sitting still in Zazen is one of the greatest teachers that we have. Yeah, we have people we call teachers. But for me, the deepest teacher is this impossible practice of sitting with whatever's arising. Michael named a few of the kinds of things that arise. But right here, right now, you may notice that you have to move. Your nose itched. Or you really love what Michael said or what I'm saying, and you really want to nod and smile. Or maybe there's something going on in your body that just is unbearable, and you can feel how if this talk lasts any longer, you will go insane, maybe explode with the negativity that arises in us when we come from the same place that this student came from. When cold and heat arise, how can I escape them? When my life arises in all these particularities, how can I escape it? This is the first turning of the koan. This is Dongshan's way of teaching. Keep looking at the same place and keep seeing it from different points of view. In that first point of view, which is so normal, this feeling of escape, we might say that we wish to escape as a natural thing, and that the sesshin enhances and zazen enhances that desire to escape. There are our physical conditions of wanting to shift and change, itchiness or pain or maybe tiredness. Some kind of feeling that I don't even want to be in this particular body. Maybe there's illness, as Michael mentioned, he's been plagued by illness. And I know some of you have also been plagued by illness, and right now in this moment probably are. How much I wish that these things wouldn't happen. This is normal, natural, this first layer of the koan. And so the first part of the koan is directing us to a very particular way of practicing, an opening to the way things are, especially when we don't like them. How can we open to things? It's quite counterintuitive to open to what we don't like, to open to what we hate, to open to the wish for things to be different. In that moment of wishing that things were different, there's an incredible way that we can learn about how our own minds work. It's not to be avoided, it's not to be talked away, because it is counterintuitive. Our intuition says to us, well, if something's going on that I don't like, well, I'll just go and change it and fix it. And we can see in Zazen the minute ways we do that constantly. It's quite a learning, quite a teaching. This first part of the koan, how can I avoid them, is answered by the warmth, the compassion of the teacher. Well, just go someplace where that's not happening. Go someplace where it's not cold or warm. Go someplace where there isn't any trouble. All our lives, we fantasized about that place. And as Michael said so eloquently, those of us who come to sit in Zen practice, or maybe you encountered some other spiritual practice first, a mindfulness practice, some kind of other form of Buddhism or Christianity, Judaism, Islam, so many different ways to escape, to try to escape. And that's maybe the most important word here, to try to escape. How many of us, please, this practice is so dependent on being honest with ourselves. Forget about the teachers, just to be honest with our own hearts and minds. I don't want this. Where can I go where I don't suffer anymore? How can I find this way of peace? So many people, and many of us on the screen, maybe everyone on the screen, has said at some point or another, when asked why do you practice, have said, I just want peace, contentment, harmony, calmness. I want to stop suffering. Where can I go? Well, you go to Sesshin? Maybe not. You go to some place on the planet where the weather is perfect and get hit by hurricanes and typhoons and wars. There's no place to avoid suffering. Plus, we bring ourselves wherever we go. This deep desire for avoidance, and it leads us to a seeking mind. We want to seek somewhere else. We want to be present to in a place where there's harmony all the time. And once we realize that that's not true, then we start making up something else, which is that there will be a moment in our Zen practice. We've heard about it, we've read about it, we've maybe deeply misinterpreted it. That's my opinion. We call it Kensho, or awakening, or enlightenment, Satori, all of these different words that point to something that appears to be a permanent state of peacefulness. No more trouble. Everything is seen through. So I now feel great all the time. And of course, the problem with that statement is there's a huge I in it. One of the things that Michael was pointing to, and that I want to point to as well, is that in this counterintuitive practice, things start to drop away, and we don't make that happen. We bow to circumstances. That's all we can do, because we're not in control of the universe. We're not in control of our own minds or bodies or hearts. We surrender. We surrender to Zazen, to the practice of being present to everything that arises without meddling, without interfering. That's what the student is longing for. I think that's what all of us are longing for, that place that doesn't exist, that self that doesn't exist, that's happy and peaceful. Noticing how you're receiving this right now. Maybe you're becoming restless and moving around quite a bit. Maybe you've sunk down into some deep state of receiving. It doesn't matter. Can you be aware of how it is for you right now? That's all that matters. And that will change in a heartbeat. That will change moment after moment. There's no reliance on anything permanent. This is one of the most amazing and discomforting teachings in Zen, in Buddhism in general. Nothing lasts. Nothing stays the same. Even your pains and itches and discomforts will change. The grief that Michael spoke of, the anger, fear, anxiety, happiness, and calmness. All of these emotions are like winds moving through us. So this wonderful student who asks the question, then where do I go? What do I do? I hope we're all asking this question, and that we're continuing to practice this stillness with sincerity, to allow our minds to get out of the way. We think we know what's best, but we don't. We think we know how to do this. It's impossible to do this. we just follow the guidance of our ancestors. And in that upright stillness, we can receive this amazing teaching of Dongshan. Let the cold kill you. Let the heat kill you. What is being killed? Michael certainly pointed to it, and I want to point to it again. It is the one who thinks they know how to be a person. This one who thinks they know will never get us anywhere. Eventually, as we open and open and open to the stillness and silence, things begin to drop away. As Dogen famously said, an inheritor of Dongshan's teaching many centuries later, body and mind drop away. All of the difficulties drop away, but not in the form that we think they're going to drop away. It's just that we realize that there is no me to be the center of the universe. There's just this, and now this, this thought, this feeling, this sensation, moment after moment, moving through us, but not fundamentally changing anything. Simply being present to all of this change and maintaining our stillness is how Zazen, in huge air quotes, works. In order to do this practice, we have to bow to the teachings of our ancestors. We have to have faith that other people who did this same thing found something unimaginable in the center of themselves that wasn't themselves. Who is that one? Who is the one who is hearing this talk right now? Who is feeling these feelings, sensing these sensations? The question can't be answered conventionally. And yet we keep asking in a circular motion, in a way, in our minds. When heat and cold arrive, how do we avoid them? Well, go to the place where there is no heat and cold. Where is that place, we ask? When it's hot, let the heat kill you. And when it's cold, let the cold kill you. Thank you. So please ease your posture, and we'll have our Dharma dialogue. For those of you who are new to our sesshins, this is an opportunity now to come forward from your own experience always, not some book you read or some expertise you think you have, but the expertise of your own heart, body, and mind, coming forward to ask a question or make a comment. And Michael and I, and we'll be joined by David, who's sitting right next to me, will respond to these things. All you have to do is be courageous, as David encouraged us to do last night, and raise your Zoom hand, and we will call on you and respond to you. So we're going to start with Marcus.
Thank you both for the talk. I think what arose for me was, you know, really the dualistic thought process of hot versus cold, good versus bad. And, you know, I think killing them by, you know, being alive of what your experience of, if you're hot, you're hot. If you're mad, you're mad. If, you know, eliminating that, that dualism, I mean, because that is what being alive is. If you're dead, you're not going to have to worry about hot and cold and good and bad. So be aware of what you're experiencing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful teaching. Thank you, Marcus, for the immediacy of it. So clearly not a philosophical investigation. Well, what is hot? What is cold? But as you're pointing so clearly, to be close to what is here, to enter physically here, of course, emotionally and all these other ways too. But the path is in every moment, and this paying attention to this and this and this. Nothing else is required. No grand strategy. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Marcus. Joanne.
Thank you for that beautiful talk. I am very grateful that the ancestors speak to the teachers to keep doing what the ancestors did. Because, there's a lot, feels like there's a lot to be eroded, and yet it gives, I feel, so many opportunities to see, including that I realize that part of what might be holding me back is my clinging to not being able to explain this to anyone. And there's something very generous about being able to see that. There's something really freeing and connecting.
You're talking about your desire to explain it as the thing that you enter. Yeah.
That I, well, just seeing that, oh, I might be holding back because there's some compulsion I have to being able to talk about whatever I'm doing, in life, in, and that it's okay to not be able to explain it. It's the fan in winter. It's so many things. Yeah. Thank you.
So beautiful, Joanne, and beautifully expressed, I have to say. When we this is the counterintuitive part. This is the part that Michael and I were both pointing to. If you try to make the effort to express it, you get all tangled up. But when something releases, and I think it takes a while for that to happen, because we can't just say, I'm done with it, right? I wish we could, I wish I could. But something begins to loosen through this practice. You've been practicing for many years, and that loosening allows something to come forward, which is surprising.
And inexplicable,
Yeah.
weird, wonderful. The little mind wants to help. Well, let me figure it out for you. It doesn't work that way. We can notice that striving, and there is something much closer, more obvious here. Yeah.
Joanne, I believe not explaining is a gift that you can give yourself and others. Because when we explain it, it's never the thing. And we create the story that reifies some false or some structure that isn't it. And we can give it to others and make a mess of it instead of just being it.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. Rich.
Yeah, I was quite moved by Michael talking about his life and Melissa talking. This idea of meddling, I found pretty interesting, but first came to mind is, yeah, I can learn how to do that with my kids, and I certainly see it in other people. But when it comes to like my mind telling me what to do, think about that as don't meddle with this. That's a bigger challenge to me.
Well, and of course, the way we enter is through being present with the meddling. Right? It's kind of a head on top of a head. Well, I'm going to stop the meddling with my meddling of the meddling.
Right.
And I think what Michael and Melissa are saying so clearly is that Just being aware, just seeing this meddling is not something new, unique to you, right? This is life. And so if we try to exclude meddling, we've just done a more sophisticated version of it. So we go, oh, yes. Oh, yes. Right?
I think it might be a rule of thumb whenever a Zen teacher tells you to stop doing something.
Something.
It's time to turn towards it and really investigate it. Say, what is this? Maybe do it more. You know, like for people who are restless during Dharma talks, maybe like scrap, be like a monkey, you know, just move around, like feel what it's like to that one. And for you with your mind, you're the only person here who has an active mind. You know that, right?
I know.
But this crazy mind, this wild mind that we all have, to just give it some room. Like Suzuki said, you know, if you want to control your sheep, you give it a bigger pasture. Just right. So it's not about I'm going to be some kind of Zen robot now and really do this thing. No, I'm going to open. What is this? What is this? And it almost wears itself out. I always remember in Zorba, the Greek, the Katsenzakis book, Zorba has an addiction to eating strawberries. And he decides to get vats and vats and vats of strawberries and eat them until he throws up and gets sick. And then he doesn't want strawberries anymore. In a way, we have to give ourselves the room to get sick. All of these ways that get in the way of this right here. Doesn't mean you have to make yourself sick.
Right.
I've made myself sick over and over and over again with my mind, you know, and my emotions and stuff that I protest against and all the objecting. It's just like, whoa, it's amazing, really. So thank you. Thank you for that, Rich.
Kindness,
Okay, Brad.
I just want to make sure I'm unmuted.
You are.
Good. The who is really intriguing for me, and it almost seems like two things. One is the ache in my hip and my tiredness, and the koan is an invitation to just to turn toward it or just to experience it rather than wishing I wasn't. And then the who is the one. And that's always there. The ache goes away, but the who never does. And
as an inquiry, Brad.
As someone there to, someone there objecting to the ache, someone there choosing to turn toward.
Who is that one?
Who is that one? Yeah, that's the question.
We were with you up until that moment, and then who never.
It would be nice. I like it when I lose the who, you know, when I'm busy just sitting or just snowboarding or just talking to somebody, and no who for a while, is a nice place. And it also seems like the center of practice to me. And kill yourself means like lose the who somehow. That's how I'm hearing it.
Or again, I want to, you know, we're all so good at coming up with strategies. So here's the strategy. I am going to kill the one who is. Of course we do that. But this awareness, and I think this is where you're coming from, too, of just noticing how incessant that is. That the tail of the buffalo going through the window, this lingering sense of, well, it's me, and then also noticing and being present with those moments where you do not drop it, you do not kill anything But you're just, you know, on the mountain on your snowboard. You're just taking a shower. And so we, these moments of release and moments of contraction, we're invited not to fix any of them, but just to notice them, to welcome. Oh, now this.
And Brad, you could ask yourself, what if you never had a who to lose in the first place?
All right. Thank you. Thanks so much. Lisa.
I loved the combination of your two approaches to this teaching. I'd never heard this before, but it is really relevant to me and the way I live. And there's constantly this striving, however subtle I might think it is, to escape from the pain. Mm-hmm. And it is omnipresent. Mm-hmm. And so it is, as you say, counterintuitive, but it seems that all my avoidance strategies have not worked. That I can say for sure. So I think this is very profound to actually let those feelings be there and think, okay, this is an anxious Buddha, and it's just the way it is, and not to keep thinking there's something wrong here, I got to adjust it, I must be thinking wrong. Well, my conceptualization is a very big part of the trap I get into. So this was really helpful. I'm so glad to have heard both Michael and Melissa, both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. You know the teaching seems to have landed just now. Don't think that's permanent either, right? It because that, like Brad was saying, the who, there's something that seems to persist. It keeps coming back, coming back, coming back. It's not real. It's not an actual thing. But the insight, when we hear a teaching and we go, yes, then stay with it as long as possible. But I love what David said, beware of turning it into a strategy. Now I know how to do it, right? You know exactly, I saw your face just light up, right? Because this is what human beings do. We are strategizing animals. And we do it with this terrible pain. Nobody wants pain. All beings want to avoid pain and move towards pleasure. That's just built into our DNA. And yet we're asking people to do this other thing, which sometimes means when the pain is unbearable, we can't just kill ourselves with it. I always think of it as a big fire. And in Zazen, we're getting closer and closer to the fire, the pain, as much as we can. And then we all have our strategies for backing away. Thank goodness. And then we go back, though, because we're courageous. Closer to the pain, and then back again. And so this swinging in towards meeting the world as it is, it's not easy to do. We can't just decide to do it in our heads, but we can start to be swingers, right? We can swing towards them and then go, whoa, no, no, I've got, where's the drugs? Where's, like, help me. Back and forth, back and forth. Yeah, so beautiful, Lisa. Thank you for sharing that insight. Really lovely. Thank you. Anne L.
Yeah, thank you for the talks. I've often found that I can deal with the pain at the moment. What I can't have deal with is my fear of what's going to happen next. It's wherever the heat is now is okay, but I'm sure that down the road it's going to be much, much worse.
Oh, yeah.
And it's amazing. I've been through terrible things, and while they're happening, it's okay. But my fear of where they're going to go or if they're going to happen again is what gets me. It's like being with what is. It's like, what is, don't let yourself move one step ahead and
Yeah.
just stay exactly where you are. And that's really difficult.
Yeah, it is so difficult. I
Yeah.
mean, all this sounds like, oh yeah, that's great. But I love what you notice, have noticed in your own experience. All of us have been through terrible things. And then we tell the story of what's going to happen in the future. But there is some way, even in the most difficult situation, that it's just this. There's just this happening. It's terrible. It's painful. I'm my heart is being broken open. My heart is being broken open, right? And so there is some discipline. I love Melissa mentioned too of come back. The mind, notice the mind running away, and we take refuge. And we cannot take refuge in the future, but we can take refuge. Oh, this, and return, and return.
And the work that you're pointing to, I think you gave a perfect description of how anxiety functions. And I consider myself a bit of an expert on anxiety because I've had it so much in my life. And just I it amazes me. Talk about the who coming back and everything coming back. Oh, I know it's a mental construct. I really know that intellectually. And yet when it arises, what's going to happen next? As you say, entering into the actuality of the moment, not a problem. Can we enter into the actuality of the anxiety? That's the work we're doing. So to really break it down at that moment and say, whoa, I am just dreaming into this chaotic future of mine. Oh, it's going to be so terrible. That's all thinking. And then to notice the repercussions in my body when I think like that, the heart beating faster, the stomach in knots. Oh, that's what's happening now. So anxiety for the future, it's always for the future, is, in my opinion, is happening now. It's all happening now. There's no you get what I'm saying, Anne. I can tell. And the this is the double-sided quality, that it's like this, and it's also here all the time, all the time. This is the counterintuitive nature of it. If I pay attention to my anxiety, I can't tell you how many people have said this very thing I'm about to say. If I pay attention to my anxiety, it's just going to get worse. If I pay attention to my pain, it's just going to get worse. And on some level, that's kind of true because the mind whips up. But on another level, the vastness enters the picture. And suddenly we're beginning to see, oh, look, anxiety. I know you. You're one of my closest friends. And others of us have other things that we're all experts on, I think, fear and greed and sadness. Some of us are sadness experts. It doesn't matter what we're experts in, that's the Dharma gate. For me, anxiety is one of my best teachers. Sadness and anger and all of it. If we didn't have it, we just sort of go off in a fog all the time, not really fully alive. What a great thing. This is what we're bowing to, in the other text we read, which we didn't talk about so much. When terrible things happen, it's best to bow down. It doesn't mean it's best to say, great, wonderful. It means, okay, this is happening, whatever it is. So if it's anxiety, then woof. If it's physical pain, really intense physical pain. I have a friend, I just had a colonoscopy, and I have a friend who refuses to take the medication that eases the colonoscopy. And I thought, do I want to do that? Do I want to just experience the pain? And no, I took the medicine. But the medicine has consequences too. I was adrift for days and days. And right, so it doesn't matter. Everything, we think we're aiming in a certain direction, but everything has this quality of being a Dharma gate, of being the place we can enter. Yeah. Well, thank you. And maybe
Yes, we'll go to Jenny.
Thank you both for the talk. I was hearing a lot there, and somewhere in the Dharma dialogue, I started thinking of all these horrible things like heat and cold, like frostbite and like torture scenes. And then I just started having like this physical reaction to these thoughts and like, what the hell? Why am I doing this? And is this like the mathematician trying to find counterexamples, or what is like stirring this up, this reaction? And yeah, just not wanting to be with this mind that kicks this up.
Yeah, thank you for reporting on yourself, Jenny. Our minds are indeed weird and wild places, and wonderful to see how immediate the suffering is. The mind, I assume all your toes are reasonably warm and fingers, so no frostbite here, but here, frostbite, burning, torturing. And so the being with this cold, this heat, noticing the reactivity of the body, noticing the mind, this is how it is for us human beings. And so we vow to open to be here in whatever comes, right? And we can say, where did that come from? Well, it must be this, or my it's because I'm a mathematician. No, just because you're human, right?
And it may, Jenny, it may offer some solace to know that your mind, you, are there to protect yourself. Some level of a functioning of your mind is there to help Jenny. Maybe it's a mind that wants to control, so it figures out all. Well, if I figure out all this stuff, then I'll be prepared for whatever comes next. Either way, the mind is weird and wonderful, as David said. And I personally don't believe it's trying to hurt us in any way. It works and functions in some way. So if we can function with it, and we can allow it to be, maybe give us a little more of a doorway into what's here and now in our life.
Well, and remember too, Michael said this in his talk, we're all descendants of beings who had this capacity that you're describing, Jenny, the capacity to imagine terrible things and then feel them in our bodies so that we could survive. I mean, it's really just as simple as that. The old story about the two guys, the two cavemen walking down the road, and one of them hears a sound in the bush and says, "Oh well, whatever." And then the other one says, "Oh, it could be a tiger." We're the descendants of the one who said, "Oh, it could be a tiger," because the guy who said, "Well, whatever," got eaten by a tiger. So this, it really is basic survival. It's so deeply built in that we just do it. Now we apply Zazen to it and do the things we've all been talking about here. Look at this. Just like you just described, you notice something. Wow, it's the mind is so powerful. We can think about something and have something happen in our bodies to reflect it. That's not even here. That's just amazing. And so Zazen teaches us, I think, over and over and over again, to see through that. And that's what you were describing, which was so helpful to hear. Yeah, thank you. Well, I think we should just move along. And we're going to do that, I believe, by coming back into our Zazen posture once again for a few moments. And then the practice leaders will take us into whatever is next.